My name is Bruce Berner, and I teach in the law school at Valparaiso University in Indiana. And all this week, we've been looking at a variety of issues in connection with the criminal justice system. Next week, just as a little bit of a preview, we'll be dealing with issues and cases out of the civil justice system, that is, private individuals suing each other for damages. One of the things we'll take up next week, for example, is the $2.7 million cup of coffee. You may remember the woman who spilled the coffee on herself, purchased at McDonald's, and recovered a sizable award. We'll talk a lot about that lawsuit and the kind of complexity of that lawsuit. Because you all heard a news blurb about it, maybe read an article, a short article, formed an opinion. Usually the opinion is that that's a stupid lawsuit. And how could the jury be so ignorant as to give money? We'll talk a little bit about that and some other things that were involved with that case. Tonight's topic is crime and punishment. And what I would like to do is to divide the session into two parts. In the first part, I would like to deal with a little exercise, which I actually give my students in the criminal law course. This is their first day in that course, and often it's their first day in law school, since we teach that first semester with some other courses. And I give them this exercise as a way of getting them to speak a little bit about what they think is important. It also helps me as a teacher know what I'm dealing with. So I'm going to sort of ask you to play the role of those students and to respond to the question that's asked on the sheet in front of you. If you can get your hands on a pink one, pink is better because it's easier to read. We have some additional ones that are on white, and if you have really good eyesight, you can read that too. I'm going to keep the pink one because I just don't see all that well. Next year we go to trifocals. Never been to bifocals. Took me 2 years to figure out how to play golf with bifocals. Now we're going to have to work from trifocals. And then after the discussion among all of us has gone a while, then I want to stop and kind of collect what we've done and see what we've accomplished. Then I have a few other comments about crime and punishment. And I want to leave the greatest amount of time then at the end for you to comment on any of the topics we've talked about, or to ask questions, to give an opinion, to give a sermon, whatever your form of delivering information is. I just call these simply X, Y, and Z hypotheticals. For those of you who don't, can we maybe pass a two or three up? Sorry, we always sort of forget the people who are higher than us here. I'm sorry. Good. I'll read through it too, so those of you who can't get to where you can see one. We have three people involved here, X, Y, and Z. X shoots at A for the purpose of killing A. A dies as a result. So if X shoots at A dies. Y shoots at B for the purpose of killing B. The shot misses, so B is not hurt. And then the third case, Z carelessly cleans his gun, which discharges, killing C. So in the third case, we have a killing which is an unintentional killing, but nevertheless the product of some fault of Z, and that fault is signaled with the word carelessly. There was something about the way he cleaned his gun which he wasn't careful. As among X, Y, and Z, who should be punished the most? Who should be punished the least? And why as to each? So let's just throw that open. I know which one you'll go for first because I know which one is easier.
Well, it seems to me the key is intent. In the first case, intent is there and it's carried out.
Okay.
Second, or you want?
No, that's fine. So you would put X and Y at the top, at tie ending. Is that right?
Yeah.
X and Y at the top, we should punish them the same amount?
No, no.
Oh?
Well, it's intent to carry out and intent that's not carried out.
So it isn't just intent?
No, it's whether you're smart enough to get it done, or skilled enough to get it done. If he doesn't get it done, he doesn't commit the crime. He doesn't commit the crime of murder.
All right. You're absolutely right. Let me read what I have here. In thinking about a response, avoid terms like murder or other legal words. In other words, I don't want you to predict what the law is going to do. I want us to assume for the moment what you would do. There's no law in place. You know, this is, you are queen, you are king. If you were responding to this for the first time, how would you want to punish these people in what sequence?
Z gets released.
Okay, you'd have Z at the bottom, Clem?
Z at the bottom.
Why is that?
Because he was just careless, and like you said, the other people had the intent.
Okay, so you'd put X and Y tied at the top?
Not tied. No.
Not tied.
I hadn't thought that far, but that's kind of hard. I mean, just because you're sorry and miss, you're going to get off lighter. If you're efficient, then you get a higher penalty. That doesn't seem right, but...
Odd, isn't it, that we're going to penalize X for succeeding at his chosen profession?
Yeah.
Because X did more harm than B.
You penalize the like.
X did more harm. That's a different variable. We started with the variable of intention.
Well, unless they're in the military, and we're talking about the enemy.
Nobody's in the military here. And in none of these cases is there any justification for the killing.
Okay.
So I want to wash out any idea that there's self-defense, anything like that. The first to attempt an intentional killing, which we would all agree is unjustified. You're absolutely right. As you begin to build in more facts, you might find that there was justification, you might find that there was an excuse, but let's put all the people equal for that purpose. We have a couple of variables here. We have intent, which seems to be important, and harm was mentioned as another variable. In X's case and Y's case, we have the ultimate harm. We have the death of a human being. Right? I'm sorry, in X's case and Z's case. We don't have that harm in Y's case. In X's and Y's case, we have intent. We don't have that in Z's case. Yeah.
Well, I was just going to say about Y, there would have to be a witness or somebody showed up to say that X shot or Y shot at B. B certainly couldn't come up and say, hey, Y shot at me. There's no way in this world he could prove it.
All right. Now, what I have to say is this. If it's on the pink sheet,
it's true.
of course you are.
You got a witness for this?
you are absolutely right. In the real world, when you're trying a case, of course you have to have witnesses who will get you to the point of establishing the facts. And then you tell the jury, if you find that Y shot at B with the intent to kill, then you may do this. And if you don't find that, then you should do this. But it's absolutely true that in the real world, you have to prove the facts. It's also true that in law school, we don't have the time to prove the facts in every case, and so we have a rule in law school. If I write it down on a piece of paper and say it happened, it happened. And if I say he had the intent, he had. Right, okay. So let's assume that you're right. This we would establish as a result of a lot of work in a courtroom, and the jury would say, now I believe he intended to kill.
For those people who don't want to punish Y as much, they're giving that one leeway for incompetence, and yet for the next one, they're punishing them for incompetence.
Wow, what about that? She says if we punish Y less than X, we're giving him a premium for his ineffectiveness, his incompetence. Mm-hmm. But incompetence, in this case carelessness, is exactly the whole basis for punishing Z at all, right?
So they'd like to reward people who are incompetent at murder and not reward people who are incompetent at cleaning a dead body.
Ah, okay. So what they were doing, the behavior in their eyes was different. One person was simply engaging in an innocent activity. And that's not an activity that we want to deter, right? We don't want to stop people from cleaning their guns. But if people want to be murderers, I guess we just assume they'd be ineffective.
Right.
There's something else, though, about why that troubles me deeper.
He was lucky.
Yeah, and so we get, see, we don't know, we don't have enough facts here to know if Y is unsuccessful because of ineptitude.
Right.
X could have just been more fortunate, or the victim was slower, or all kind of things that neither one has any control over. Okay. So it isn't necessarily incompetence, it may be very fortuitous that X succeeded in killing and Y didn't. That's another factor that plays in.
He might have had a second thought, too, right at the point that he shot the gun. He might have had second thoughts about doing it.
That's a real interesting possibility. There's even some cases where we can talk about the conscious and the unconscious. Is it possible that when people are unsuccessful, that they may be consciously thinking they're trying to do something and they're unconsciously stopping themselves? Some criminals are unusually inept. A lot of crimes aren't really very hard. The problem with crime is not usually that they're technically difficult, but a lot of them seem to, we see the same thing psychologically with suicides that fail over and over and over. What's really going on there? Is that really ineptitude or something else a little deeper really going on there? What you're doing is calling into question whether or not he had the intent.
He may not have had as much intent.
Correct. That's certainly true in the real world. Again, it won't play on the pink sheet because the pink sheet says he has the intent. But you're absolutely right. Intent is one of the hardest questions to prove because it's internal. And we don't have much direct access to know what a person intended. And sometimes the real difficulty is that the person herself doesn't know what she intended. Exactly. That's certainly possible. Yes, sir?
I think if we want to try to prevent future murder attempts, we might treat X and Y the same because they both want to murder people, and if we can.
Okay, so if what we're trying to do is to get out of circulation the people who have a tendency to kill on purpose, it may serve us to get them both out of circulation. And perhaps for the same length of time, do we want to keep B shorter since he might be inept? See, here's what troubles me about Y. The person that Y really hates enough to kill, is still alive. That isn't true for X. It may be that X is a safer bet to put on the street than Y, especially given that a lot of murder is relational.
Yeah.
It's done to someone that you know.
He'd kill his wife and wouldn't kill anybody else.
Right. And maybe if we just let him out and tell him he can never marry again, maybe we're totally safe from him. I don't know that a lot of people would agree with that. Yeah.
Well, this may be a real minority viewpoint, but I would like to talk about Z.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I think there's as much potential for harm, if not more, with Z. And I would like to see no guns. So I just have to throw that out.
Right. In other words, the interesting thing about Z and X is whatever the difference at the intent level, the harm they ended up causing was the same. And the families of A and C are equally harmed. Right? Their loss is the same.
Just the fact that you have a gun means that you're intending probably to kill someone. You have a gun. You're probably using it for something like that.
Right.
Yeah, I imagine there are situations where most of us would agree that you could possess a gun, and from that only we wouldn't infer that you intend to kill human beings with it. Or maybe we would infer in certain situations that you have the gun to protect yourself, and you will only kill if your life is threatened. That's at least a possibility. That's what the Getz case really began to turn on. Why is Bernie Getz packing the gun? He says, the city's a rough place. The subway's a rough place. I've been attacked before. I need to defend myself. Others said, you were spoiling for a chance.
But then still others say that just having a gun is inviting this.
Right, right. That's a real, there's all kind of interesting questions about just gun possession, gun ownership, etc. And we can we can talk about that too. And then we can have the war of bumper stickers. Because each side has some wonderful bumper stickers on the question. Yeah.
I have another comment about Z.
Yeah.
What if I changed Z to saying, Z carelessly drives his car while he's drunk and runs into C, killing him?
Yeah, that at least clears up the gun problem, the weapon problem,
yeah.
Right? My guess is legally it puts us in pretty much the same place.
Yeah.
Carelessly cleaning your gun, carelessly using your car, will probably end us up in the exact same place, both legally and maybe not morally. I think people view guns differently.
I think they do too.
Yeah, but I think if people are happier with Z carelessly driving his car and running someone down, I'm willing to change the pink sheet to that extent.
Well,
I very seldom will I change a pink sheet. If you get a green sheet, I'll be real easy, but the pink ones I like to stick with. Yeah.
Well, the reason why I wanted to change it is because a lot of people have emotional issues about driving a car and that, or drunk driving a car, and that is something that society says is should be punished severely, or at least in my opinion. Whereas carelessly cleaning your gun is not something that at least I've traditionally heard as one of those.
There's a lot of accidents that happen that you actually people have killed their own children.
Mm-hmm.
You know, mm-hmm. And you don't intend to kill your own children when you're driving. See, there's no intent at all when you're cleaning your gun, as far as just to clean your gun.
And driving your car drunk is illegal.
All right, but what she's done here, and we have a word for this in law school. It's called double loading the hypothetical. You've got someone carelessly driving a car and drunk.
Okay.
What I want to do is separate that, because you get the same kind of emotional punch from drunk driving that many people get from gun.
Mm-hmm.
So let's just say Z carelessly drives his car and kills C. Now, one thing almost immediately changes when you say it that way. You see what it is? Why is it you're a little slower there?
Mm-hmm.
Let's punish him as much as X, or a little bit less than X, or maybe a little more than Y. Why do you begin to hesitate if all we say is that Z carelessly drives his car and kills C?
Because we all drive a car.
Because you begin to identify in that problem. You say, in the first two problems, you say, if I were ever to be someone in that problem, God forbid I should be anybody in that problem, but I'd probably be A or B. Right? I sure wouldn't be X or Y, because that's just not the kind of person I am. But when you see the third one, you go, uh-oh, I could be either of those people. So I need to go a little slower. That's one of the real problems with punishment, and the way you react to it is, who do you identify with in the punishment situation? Do you readily identify just with the victim, or do you readily identify with both? We had a debate one time about the death penalty, and I was taking the position in the argument opposed to the death penalty, and another person said, what if it was a member of your family that was killed? Then how would you feel about it? And the only way I could respond is, I'm willing to play that game if you're willing to assume that it was a member of your family that did the killing. Because you can't load the problem up emotionally just on one side and let the other party have all kind of rational. Yeah, but it affects the way we think about it, doesn't it? I don't like to punish Z real harshly, because I can imagine being in Z's position. I drive a car, sometimes too fast. So this could happen.
Yeah. We haven't talked about any psychiatric or psychological problem, but there might be intent, but it's...
Yeah, I want to assume that away for now. That's absolutely true. And we had a session on that Tuesday night about the whole insanity problem. Let's assume, for our purposes, that there's no element of either justification or excuse. And insanity or psychiatric problems would certainly be... In other words, I want to leave all the variables out except the ones on the page.
You just want us to look at the facts.
Yeah, I'm sorry. That's what I do. Well, the interesting thing about the problem is I think that everyone will agree that the very best treatment we would ever give X is tied for the most punishment.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Okay? Nobody would have X getting lesser punishment than anyone else. We make some interesting cases about where Y goes and where Z goes. What I found is most people want Y below X, but above Z. Okay. There's a few people that make a pretty good argument to put Z above Y. When they do that, they're focusing then more on the harm. They're coming at it more with a kind of a victim identification. There's a lot more harm, and because there's a lot more harm, there has to be a lot more pay. Mm-hmm. I think most of us instinctively think that intent is a more important variable than harm, because intent gets closer to what we might call moral blameworthiness, how bad the person is. We kind of see, in some ways, Z is a victim himself. He's caused a great harm that he didn't intend to create. In some way, we see that.
Can I ask a question about intent? I mean, you said not to use technical terms in our answer, but it seems to me that I would be very surprised if lawyers didn't have a pretty good idea as to what is a definition of intent, and it's not just 1 minute before the person comes in and you're there with your gun and you say, I'm going to kill this person. I mean,
yes, it is. Yes. Yeah, that would be intent. Intent can be formed just seconds before you do it.
Seconds before.
Yeah. When you get into what I think you may be referring to is, in some states, murder gets graded into a higher grade if it's premeditated. Mm-hmm. And so if it's a planned, cold-blooded, premeditated killing, in many states, instead of just being murder, it becomes first-degree murder. Mm-hmm. And then the penalty gets higher. Yeah.
So this might be somebody who's very angry, and this is almost instantaneous, or it could be somebody that's planned this for a while.
Correct.
Yeah, okay.
Correct. But if you want to make X a premeditator, I'm going to make Y a premeditator. And if X just thought of it, then Y just thought of it. I don't want to let you play with the variable. Let's come at this a different way, and actually you pretty much covered them all. But a different way of looking at this problem, and I've played a little trick on you here. I've really played a little trick on you, and I play it on the students every time I do these hypotheticals. Because I begin by having you approach this, how much should the people be punished? The problem with that is there's a question that has to be answered first. You've begun to answer it in the way you answer the question. What led you to say this person gets punished more than that or less than that? And what I tell the students is always why before what? Always why before what? So what we start with is, what are we doing when we punish? What's the purpose for punishment? If we know what the purpose is, we can begin to get a much cleaner fix on how much of it is indicated. Let's see how much we can get up on the board. What are some of the reasons we punish? And let's talk about punishing for serious crime, usually with a punishment involving incarceration. Not necessarily, but usually. What are we doing when we punish?
Retribution.
The R word, right? One of the R words.
Revenge.
Yeah, there's the other R word. That one has a little more sting to it, doesn't it?
Yeah. Rehabilitation.
Well, there's another R word.
Yeah, but forget that one. We don't do it.
Well, keep other people from doing it.
Huh?
Keep other people.
Okay, well, let's have a word for that. Keep other people from doing it.
Deterrence.
Deterrence, yeah. Actually,
safety.
Deterrence.
Deterrence, or, which is also, that's a fancy word.
Prevention.
Yeah, for prevention.
Right.
Prevention, $25 an hour. Deterrence, $50 an hour. Always looking for those $50 an hour words, right, for lawyers. I always tell the students, bone up on your Latin. That could be $100 an hour, right? Prevention.
Public safety.
Safety.
So remove.
Remove.
Yeah, remove. Isolation. We usually talk, that's usually restraint. The restraint of the person so they can't do it again. The interesting thing about deterrence is there's two aspects to deterrence. They're called special and general. The special deterrent effect of a sanction means the effect that it has on the person sanctioned. Right? What effect does it have on the exact person punished in terms of affecting that person's behavior in the future? General deterrent effect means what is the effect on all other people who learn of the punishment, people who might be similarly motivated. Okay? And that kind of general deterrent effect is sometimes called the educational effect of sanctions or of punishment. We don't need to talk much about the death penalty, but it's important here in connection with the educative value of punishment. What happens now when the death penalty is levied? Do you hear about it? Of course, you hear about it. You don't hear about it, unless you do a lot of research, you can't find who's spending time in jail. But the death penalty happens seldom enough in an area that you hear about. Until the late 19th century, whenever the death penalty was executed, everyone who lived in that immediate vicinity was required to attend. Was required attendance hanging. Because it was felt that the educative benefit of it would be lost unless you watched it happen, unless it became real to you. Anybody know what happened to stop that practice?
Pickpockets.
No.
That's not bad.
What'd you say?
Pickpockets.
Yeah. I love it. You try to do an education against crime, and the pickpockets put it to their own use. No, the required attendance at hangings appears to happen simultaneously with the rise of daily newspapers. So once there's another vehicle to get the information of the people of the death penalty, then they don't have to be there now. They can read about it in the paper. We know they're going to read that. So that you can trace one to the other. There. Yeah.
What was the penalty for not showing up?
I don't know. They didn't, do an encore for you the next day. But there was a penalty involved.
Women and children too.
Huh?
Women and children too.
Yes. Everyone was to attend. Which we talked a little bit about this the other night. One of the arguments that you'll always hear in connection with the death penalty is if you are doing the death penalty for a general deterrent effect, if that's the purpose for it, then it ought to be on television. Okay. If you want to, later, we can talk about that because that's kind of a grisly thing to think about. Safety, restraint, anything else?
Time to reflect and repent.
Yeah, I think that's sort of a part of what the rehabilitation movement is about. Rehabilitation means rehabilitation in the total sense. That the time, especially the time incarcerated in an incarceration situation, is time for the person to think, to pay back, and by the way, that repent business, the theological end of this is interesting. Because if you convicted someone and sentenced them to death, if they became insane after that, you could not put them to death. And the theory was that they did not get the chance at that point to make their theological peace before they met death. So they had to be sane not only at the time of the crime and of the sentencing, but also at the time the death penalty was handed out.
How about politics?
Hmm?
How about politics?
How about it?
Well, I'm a sheriff, and if I get enough convictions, I get reelected and so on.
Yeah, that's right. And prosecutors who are very worried about their success record. Because
both,
that can
both
be...
Both for defense and prosecution.
Really. Yeah. Those are reasons that people, individual people in the system might have. We're trying to think here of just sort of what do we all have invested in? What as a society, what are we doing when we punish? But you're absolutely right. That gets displaced a little bit by individual actors having their own agenda. Right? Sure. Anything else? Those are the basic ones. And I can tell you that the main two that all theories are revolving around today are retribution and deterrence. The rehabilitation movement was very big in the 50s. And for the most part, while there's still a lot of work being done with it, for the most part, it's not a serious contender as a main basis for punishment. For one thing, if rehabilitation is the purpose for punishment in the form of incarceration, we are doing one heck of an awful job. Because that does not appear to be the measurable effect of incarceration. In fact, the measurable effect appears to be quite the opposite. That is that people, generally speaking, come out worse at the other end and not better. This also travels under a lot of other names. Retribution is kind of institutionalized revenge. That's one way of thinking about it. But retribution is also a kind of a felt impulse. That is, we think it's just right. We talk about just deserts. And my students always, when they write that on an exam, they spell it D-E-S-S-E-R-T-S. So it sounds like something you have after dinner, but that's not what just desserts is here, right? That is, you get this penalty because somehow it's right for you to get the penalty. It's a very Kantian notion. You do something wrong, we have to. If you do a minus, we have to put a plus in here to balance it. The next question is, how much? The unit of currency for serious crime is time in jail. So let's say a year in jail is the unit of currency. Where would you guess, in terms of actual years spent, where would you guess America is in connection with the whole world? High end, low end, middle end?
High end. Highest.
Okay. Right, that's what everybody assumes. It is the lowest. It is the lowest when you compare crime to crime, actual time served.
It is the lowest.
It's the highest. Yeah. And you said highest. I'm back. It's the highest. Okay. A couple of crimes you can find where a few cultures have it higher. South Africa has some real high penalties for certain kinds of things. Okay. There's a few Asian countries that have high penalties for certain kind of things, like don't get caught with a marijuana cigarette in Turkey. You'll be there a very long time. Okay. And in other places, you'll be caned. And then after you're caned, you'll become famous in America. You'll remember that. But it's higher. One of the things that's interesting to keep in mind here is, and I find that an awful lot of people have a funny notion about this. You guys just shocked me by all knowing the right answer, because most people will assume that we're not punishing enough, because the politicians tell us we're not punishing enough. If only we would get some harsh punishment. You could punish a little faster. That appears to be something that we're probably behind on. Our system does work awfully slow. One thing that upsets people is they'll say, well, we give them 20 years, but then they come out in 10. They never serve their right sentence. There's a trick in there that most people see, and Jim Farrell's been talking all week about what he calls invisible complexity. They're wonderful sessions. In fact, he told me last night, he came to my session, he says, that's what you're doing too, it's invisible complexity. And I felt brilliant, because this was, it was invisible to me that this is what I was doing. So I figured, you know, if that's, it's like an artist who's entitled not only to what he meant by the picture, but all the brilliant things that other people get from it, he gets to own that too. So here's how it works. Let's say we want to punish someone, and we think that what's appropriate is 5 years. Should we write in the statute, if you commit this crime, you'll go to prison for 5 years? Well, we can do that, but we're going to find something out pretty quickly. The people who run the penal institutions want to know, how do we keep order in here? What kind of system of incentives can we use to have people behave themselves while they're here? As you can imagine, if you thought a junior high classroom was tough, picture that this population, right? Especially if it's the kind of place which has a lot of violent offenders. Well, you can play with it. You can create a little bit of a hierarchy. On the high end, you can make them a trustee, or they can eat early, or they can eat better, or you can sell script, and they can get a little more in the prison bookstore. Had to get bookstore in there. Get bookstore in there. Or other things, or you could get sheets every third week instead of every fourth week or something. Or you can create a hierarchy on the bottom, that is, the really bad people go into solitary confinement and they do other things. Well, there's a limit to how effective that is, and one thing that most people in prison want, and want more than anything else, is out. And so what has happened is, the wardens say, if we had a system where so long as they behave themselves, they get credit and can get out faster, that will really help us. Well, if we thought 5 years was right, you know what we do? We make it 10. We put 10 in the statute, and then we say, and by the way, you'll get a day for a day, good time. So every day that you're good on this end, we'll take one day off on this end. Okay? You got to keep being good because, you know, you build them up one day at a time, but you lose them a lot of the time, sometimes all the time. So you have to be good kind of constantly. And then we end up, and if the person is good while in prison, he gets out after 5. A lot of people don't know what's behind that, and they say, well, he didn't get punished as much as we want. Well, he really did, because what we were aiming at all the time is 5. Let me stop here and see what kind of questions you have about the crime system, the crime rate, punishment.
I believe that in the federal system, there is no parole anymore. You get good time, but there's no possibility of parole. But I believe that in some states, you can still gain parole if you're particularly good.
Yes, some states have a discretionary system, so when you reach a particular minimum portion of the sentence, you know, the old way of talking about it was you get 10 to 30. There was a minimum and there was a maximum, there was a range. And then once you hit the minimum, if it wasn't stated that way, usually you were eligible for parole after one-third of the sentence. That was the historical formula. The federal system uses a good time provision, not a parole provision. The federal system also uses the new federal sentencing guidelines, which are very, very intricate and precise in terms of you get more months added for this and months subtracted for that. A good friend of mine is a federal judge, and he said it used to be doing sentencing was doing justice. Under the new guidelines, it's more like doing algebra. Okay. You got each thing is worth a certain point, and you have to add them all together.
Overcrowding seems to be a reason to boot people out now, too. Less than 5, sometimes they'll get booted out. 3 years.
They'll have room for them.
Because they don't have room for them, we can't build prisons fast enough.
Yeah, and of course there's a whole debate about whether we've historically overused prisons, whether we're putting people in there who could be dealt with in a better way. They're horribly costly. We don't know that they're particularly effective. A lot of states are full. In Indiana, about 6 years ago, a letter went out to all the judges, and here's what the letter said. It was from the Department of Corrections, State of Indiana. We are full. You are hereby put on notice that if you send anyone in through the front door, we are sending someone out through the back door. And by the way, we don't have any just regular thieves left. It's all just violent people who are left. But, you know, thank you for your consideration. So what do you do? Well, the system is working on, in a lot of areas, pilot programs, trying to figure out responses that don't involve, you know, for lesser offenses. We're not, you know, don't get the picture that murderers will go on a picnic or something. But for lesser offenses, that we look at alternatives to incarceration, that it hasn't been a particularly effective way of dealing with the problem.
Sorry. Another thing, talking to people who work in prisons, it's becoming quite a problem in California. People over 55 who probably are no longer a danger. They came in at 20 or 22. Many of them have serious medical problems. Some of them require nursing home care. They're in there for life. And there's a lot of people who think we ought to let those people out, put them in a nursing home, because some of them are even bedridden now. And it's costing the state a tremendous amount of money to keep people with those kind of medical needs in a prison when they could be in a community program where they would receive care at much less expense and the same medical care as they would receive in prison. But with the prison component, you increase the cost dramatically.
I think that's absolutely right. And I think the way you react to that depends on where you are here. If you are someone who's concerned about your safety and restraining people and deterrence, once we have someone who just doesn't appear to be a threat anymore, the instinct is to say, what's the point? It costs too much. If you came at it more from beginning with the idea of payback, retribution, just desserts, revenge, you don't necessarily feel that way. One very interesting sort of case in point there is how the Jewish people felt when some of the Nazi prisoners got to be very old, and the point came to, you know, what's the point of holding Hess anymore? Well, you'd hear about it if you asked what the point was. You'd hear what the point is. So, you know, that felt retribution there is at work too.
Part of the reason for the states reacting that way is that the Supreme Court decisions, which leave them in a legally poor position. And one other comment I have is one thing in deterrence, if we can somehow develop a certainty of punishment or a certainty of being caught, that would be a deterrent.
Absolutely. Deterrence. Psychologically, the way deterrence works, makes perfect sense, the only way it could work, is the severity of the penalty multiplied by your perception of how likely you are to get caught. It doesn't matter how serious or how grave the penalty is. If you don't believe there's any chance of getting caught, there's no deterrent effect to it. The interesting thing about what we know about the psychology of criminals is most of them greatly overestimate their ability to get away with it. Okay. Actually, their ability to get away with it is very high, much higher than most police departments will tell you. Most crimes are not solved. Okay. They don't like to tell you too much of that because that's not, doesn't make people feel very, very good. But however good a person's chances are to get away with it, they actually think they're better. They actually overestimate it. So that's why it's real difficult to deter people unless you can persuade them that they're going to be caught.
You know, one factor that I haven't seen up there is of the defendant, the guilty party, how remorse he was and how he acted in court and so forth. That a lot of times plays a factor.
How we feel about the person when we watch the person undergo trial.
In Pauli Cross there, where he flipped the cameras off. And the jury took that personal and gave them a harsher sentence because it was more directed at them than the actual deed.
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was present in the courtroom after this was a murder trial in Indiana. They found the defendant guilty, and the next part of the hearing was whether they would deliver the death penalty. This was in about 1985. The defendant's name was Steve, first name, and. There comes that point in the death penalty phase after all the lawyers had at it and argued, and the jury is about to decide whether it's the death penalty or not the death penalty, where the judge says to the defendant, is there anything you would like to say? And much to the chagrin of his lawyer, Steve had something to say. And he stood up and he said, if I ever get out, I'll kill again. And the first people I'll look for are you. At which point, the foreman of the jury said, and I give him great credit for this, say goodnight, Steve. So, yeah, the way, that's right. And the problem with that, of course, is that it can be exploited, too, and lawyers know how to exploit it.
So do sociopaths.
So do sociopaths, right. They know the game. You know, you've all seen it happen. What's the first thing a defense lawyer does with the client? You get him a haircut?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Different kind of clothes? Yeah. Some defendants won't have it. I've had defendants who, they're going to be who they are. And, you know, they say, and then they insist on taking the stand. That's the other thing about some of them. And you go, oh, okay. Well, I'm not going to waste my time doing a lot of research because if you take the stand, we're going down. Yeah.
When I was in college a long time ago, the research then showed that the death penalty had no deterrent effect on murder.
Right.
Has that changed in the past?
No. No. Although I think there's a little bit of a trick in there. It depends on what you mean by deterrent effect.
Well, in contiguous state studies, I think they always cited there was no difference between the ones that had it, and the murder rates were the same.
Correct. And the before and after studies in the same state doesn't make any difference. But my point is, you're talking about general deterrent. You're not talking about the specific deterrent.
Right. There was more people overestimating that they won't get caught.
Right.
It didn't seem to have any effect.
Because one thing we know absolutely true, and the research is solid on this, no one has ever committed a crime after they've been the subject of the death penalty. Which is to say, the special deterrent effect of the death penalty can't be doubted. It's an axiom, right? But you're right. In terms of the research on the general effect, the effect on others, I don't think we quite say it that it doesn't have an effect. What generally say is we cannot show that it has an effect. We cannot prove either way. The data is just inconclusive on whether or not it appears to be overpowered by other determinants, the murder rate.
Do you think, though, that if it were used more, like, say, in California, we have so many on death row, don't you think if all of those guys got it, and we didn't have them doing it one every 10 years or whatever, that would be a deterrent?
I think it's an interesting question of what would happen if we did more of it, and we're about to. The numbers you suggest we're about to. And if we televised it, that's why I always bring that television up, people go, televise it, you know, well, which way would it go? It would have a greater deterrent effect, or if it would so horrify people to see it that there would be a movement to get rid of it, or that we'd just get hardened by the whole thing.
Yeah, the size and crowd of San Quentin has been going down in the last 3 executions. It's almost gone down by half each time.
There's only very few countries in the world that still do it. We're one of them. In the back there, I don't even... Yes, sir?
No. The matter of the death penalty is kind of interesting to me because of a certain book I've been reading just recently. I can't even remember the name. But you've got the, you know, they can shoot a guy, they can hang him, they can gas him, whatever it is. But all of these in themselves doesn't mean that the person is still going to go through a death experience, because we got all the people out there who are ready to take pot shots at that specific method of applying a means of death.
Right.
So there's another element here
that
I don't think we've touched on yet, and also plays a big part. Even within this room, if you took a show of hands, how many really believe in the death penalty, you know? Or are there other means? And I think that's, again, where I'm coming from, and maybe others.
You get a smaller percentage in favor of the death penalty in this room than you would in the general population.
I think so. Yeah.
There's no question about that. A lot of states don't have.
You know, talk.
Well,
this gets back to the same thing, but like where you have Z carelessly cleans his gun, which discharges, okay, the person is dead.
Right.
Okay. And one of our sisters who you spoke up mentioned instead have them kill him with a car. Okay, right there you have a difference because that involves insurance with insurance companies and cars. And
not in the criminal case it doesn't involve insurance. In the civil case it would involve insurance.
Right.
Right.
But so right now I don't think what happens is a person uses a gun, they can still use it again. There isn't any gun control sort of thing, is there? I don't know. We don't own guns, so I'm not.
Well,
but that's a deterrent. What I'm saying is
right.
There's a built-in deterrent to certain crimes that
right.
there aren't to others. And
correct. No, I think that's
it
right.
It still has an implication on what we do as a society with it, because insurance companies have computers and they, the way they set rates, they project if this is, quote, a careless person, you
right.
know?
Right.
Carelessness is projected into, you know, costs and everything.
Sure, sure.
So I don't know if we'll ever have to get
right.
into that careless part that way, but.
What would actually happen in these three cases, in most American jurisdictions today, X commits the crime that we simply call murder. It might be first-degree murder, it might be second-degree murder, depending on things like premeditation and how long he thought about it ahead of time. And he would be punished the most harshly, perhaps by the death penalty, in those states which have it. Y commits the crime called attempted murder, which in almost every jurisdiction draws a lower penalty than murder. Not in all. In some, the amount of penalty is the same. There are some states that say the penalty for murder and attempted murder are the same. Those states are obviously putting a lot of premium on intention. An intention to kill is an intention to kill. And all you can ever deter is the attempt. Whether the thing is successful or not is that's not deterrable. The attempt is what you can deter. And Z, in almost every state, commits a crime variously called involuntary manslaughter or reckless homicide and is punished a good deal less. In each of the three cases, there's also a civil action. In each of the three cases, the victim or the victim's family can sue for damages. That's a separate case, though. That's not the criminal case. But Z commits some form of manslaughter, usually called involuntary manslaughter, because he didn't intend to kill. But it's still a homicide, and it still typically draws some incarceration, though smaller than the others. Yeah.
Recently there was a case of a homicide, a murder that was killed by injection. And there was a big, I didn't get this until just now. I think that there was a big argument in the press because the press were not allowed in until after he was already strapped down and out. And so this was about the educational stuff?
Oh, okay. Right. Yeah. And that was the point back there, too. A lot of the argument now is over the means of delivering the death penalty. The argument moves from should we have the death penalty to how should we do it. As you may have guessed from all this week, even though my daughter's a journalist, I'm not a particular fan of the media. You notice how the press always gets very interested in people's rights when it's theirs.
Yeah.
And so we always hear about the First Amendment right. Every year I write the local papers in my area, and I say, every time I see an article from them about your right to know, I don't want to know half the things they tell me I have a right to know, but your right to know, where are that? I write them and I say this, why is it that every day in the newspaper, you publish the names of the people who were arrested? Sometimes they were unfairly arrested, and sometimes they're never convicted. But they have such a stigma from the name in the paper that all the acquittals in the world won't remove it. Why don't you care about their constitutional rights? And they write me back, the public has a right to know, and we're defending the Constitution. Well, they're defending one part of it. There's this other part that I want them to think about too, but But yeah, so that's interesting to me, that we're delivering the death penalty, and we're doing lethal injection, and what the press cares about is they didn't get in time to see the beginning part. Yeah, that's interesting.
You commented about the severity of the sentences here. What about the number of people that are in prison for in the United States compared to the other countries?
I think it's the third highest. I think at one point the percentage of population in prison was higher in the Soviet Union and South Africa, and we were third in terms of the percentage of people in prison. We talked a little bit about this the other day.
Now maybe it's first place.
That's my question, too. I thought we were number one. That's what I thought you were asking before when you...
the percentage.
Of any industrialized country, anyway.
Here's another number for you. When I heard this, this one really got my attention. A black male between 18 and 22, more in prison than in college.
Yeah.
Wow. Wow.
And the overall percentage of a black male, I forget by what age, it's really incredible.
Very high. Here and then, we have 2 minutes.
One of the issues they brought up that is of some interest to me, and coming from California, three strikes law, Supreme Court just turned it down, saying judges have to have a right to mete out
budget.
Budget, exactly. And I've had one experience looking at sort of the same process, but at the other end. Had one experience dealing with the parole board, and from my perception of what went on, it was one of the most capricious, non-regulated bits of the criminal justice system that I'd ever been exposed to.
The parole system?
Parole system.
100% discretionary. It's one of those pockets of discretion. That's why the feds have done away with it, basically. Well, capricious is a nice term for it.
Well, the specific case involved a guy that had been in, he was convicted of first degree murder, as it turned out. Right. As part of that process, I was interested earlier, the average time served state of Washington since 1930 was 12 years on first degree murder charges. Mm-hmm. The guy I was dealing with good time, had been in for 31 already.
Right.
No, yeah. He was no worse than anybody else.
Yeah,
he got lost in the system for that.
You get great disparities. Where do you suppose the penalties are lowest? What countries would you guess the penalties are lowest for what we call linear offenses, robbery, burglary, theft, things that we all know what they mean?
Scandinavian countries,
way down at the bottom.
They have few murders there.
So that's interesting. So,
if it's a deterrent, you know.
I don't think we can lower the penalty and expect the crime rate to go down. I mean, that's a function of different things. But it is interesting that some of the lowest crime rates are in areas that also have the lowest penalties. Yes. Behind you, and then.
Okay. I was just wanting to comment on the comment over here about if the death penalty were administered quickly and more often, would that be a deterrent? I'd just like to cite the example of Texas, who administers the death penalty about twice a month, it seems, and I believe they have a very high crime rate.
Yes. The Supreme Court of the United States decided a case 2 weeks ago, which will greatly accelerate how fast the appeals process works in death cases, so we are going to have a shorter period of time from conviction to delivery of the death penalty. And the number of people sitting on death row is at the point where one person estimated that we're going to hit the point in about 2 years where we will have to kill one a day just to keep up with the backlog in death row. Yes, sir. Last one, because I have to let you go for Vespers or I'm in big trouble.
One thing we haven't really discussed is cruel and unusual punishment. I visited prisoners in three different other countries, South Korea, Germany, and Mexico, and they don't seem to have that consideration of what's cruel and unusual. And we seem to have that, and one of the biggest problems that I find that when talking to a guard who works on death row is they're continually filing briefs saying that their punishment, even on death row, as they wait for, is cruel and unusual.
Right.
And so they're just overburdening the courts with those kinds of things. And I think we really have never come up with a good definition in this country what is cruel and unusual punishment, even though it's constitutional.
There's really two things in there. I'm not quite sure I would agree with you totally on the second, but I think you're probably close to right, that we haven't had a good definition. The other part is, when someone is is on death row, how do you deter them from filing legal papers? No matter how good the definition is, if you let them file them at all, we're going to be overburdened with those petitions we always are. Thank you all very much. Vespers is in 9 minutes.